This is Mike Godsall, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 28th of January 2013. Mike Godsall, Part 2.
You found the name of the fit who broke his wrist?
Yes, it was Ron Tyndall. And there were four of us getting onto the launch when it was still on the ship. And it was swinging about in a derricks and just letting it down. And he got his arm stuck between the canopy of the launch and the side of the ship. And that was that.
That was the accident?
Yeah.
There was another condition which the dogs apparently displayed. This is a note from Bob Burton. That they had their eye injuries from dust, windblown dust. Was that some of them
yes,
blind?
Yes, particularly at Deception,
yes.
Where it's volcanic ash, and you get corneal ulcers, which are they were quite common there, actually, and you end up with corneal opacity if they're not treated. I did do a couple of those. I think you cauterise the edge of the ulcer with silver nitrate or something, and it heals over.
And Tony Palmer, in a paper here, talked about Sir Roman Priestley being the person who instigated the idea of vets going south.
Yes.
It was a few years before you actually went off. So it did take about 7 or 8 years to actually get a vet going down south.
Mm-hmm.
He was asked to write a manual for the veterinary care of huskies in 1957-58 and wrote a 30-page booklet. Did you ever come across that?
No, I don't think I did.
Which was supposed to be on every base.
Yes. They had quite a lot of drugs and stuff on the bases, actually, which had been sent down on spec, I think.
When you got back to Britain with all your samples,
mm-hmm.
What happened next?
I arrived at Southampton, which, as I said, was 17 separate pieces of luggage. There were sort of cardboard boxes and things, and goodness knows where what it all was. But I had to get a taxi from there to home in Kent, because there's no way I'd get on a train with that lot. So I got a taxi and took a taxi all the way home. I was a bit upset my family hadn't met me, actually, to be honest. They're obviously fairly busy. But then went back up to Cambridge and resumed my job as a house surgeon. Which was actually a very busy day job, really. But it did leave me time to do quite a lot of work with microscope and sections and all the rest of it. And then that was in 1964. Then in Christmas time, my chap who was in my ear, John Parker, rang up and said, how was I fixed? Could I go and do a locum? He'd put his plate up. From nothing in Wendover in Buckinghamshire, which is a fairly brave thing to do at that. He'd only been qualified just over a year.
Mm.
And he said he'd got jaundice. And could I go and run the practice for him? So I left home on Boxing Day and went down, ran his practice for a week. And then went back to Cambridge and carried on as a house surgeon. And then come April, he rang again and said he was really desperately overworked and could I go and join him? So I did. And as soon as I got to join him in April, he got mumps, which actually was a very good thing because although he's 2.5 years younger than me and hadn't done his national service, he had the great benefit of a bald head at the age of 23. And everybody thought he was old and experienced. In fact, as I say, he was 2.5 years younger than me, but people used to ask, had to make do with the young vet, it was me. So that's how the practice got off the ground.
Well, like a scene from All Creatures Great and Small, isn't it?
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Can I just go back a bit to the work you were doing in the lab when you got back to Cambridge? And when you were studying the samples you brought back, was there any more information that came from those samples?
Not really more, and just confirmation of the extent of the arthritis and so on. And I did do quite a lot of work on the sections and stained them all. And there was it's difficult to remember exactly. I must have spent my time somehow working quite hard on it. And I did actually quite a lot of reading as well of the background to arthritis and in humans as well as dogs. And actually I wrote to a chap in Belgium about to see if there'd been any arthritis in dogs that pulled carts in the streets of Belgium, which they were still allowed to do, although dogs in England weren't allowed to pull things. And I had this contact up in Labrador as well, and that was an interesting collaboration there, actually. Managed to find a veterinarian who worked at the American Air Force base at Goose Bay, and went to stay with him for a fortnight. And he was very brazen, and he'd just go off to the Eskimos and say, "Can I have your dogs?" So we put down a sort of about half a dozen, I think, up there.
And he was finding similar?
Very similar, not as bad, but similar. And the same joints affected.
Should we have been surprised that the dogs were suffering from the workloads they were?
I think if you consider that, I think on a good surface, a nine dog team would pull something like 1,200 pounds weight. They're pulling almost twice their body weight. And really, I don't think any joint should be expected to put up with that for all that long, quite honestly. It's a terrific stress on the joints.
So, but it was this wasn't cruelty from the early FIDs. It was just...
Not cruelty at all, I don't think. No, it's just... possibly nowadays they wouldn't do it if you had, you know... but, I mean, it was the means of transport. And when I was down there, they had the first skidoo in. And I remember reading in my diary, and it went chugging off like a lawnmower, I said in my diary, you know, which is... and that was 1963, 64. And before that, there were, you know, muskegs and things. But there was virtually nothing for an individual to go off, apart from dogs. And how things have changed. You know, it's... see, skidoo is everywhere now.
You tried to publish your results.
I did.
In Bass Bulletin.
I got quite a long way with writing it all up, and I had actually by then left Cambridge, and I was in practice, which was, you know, if I'd thought I was busy as a house surgeon, it was nothing compared with being in practice. So I never used to get home till 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night sometimes. We had an evening surgery at 7. And so things were very different, and it was difficult actually to carry on writing it up. I had got microscopes and things in my... I was unmarried then, in my cottage and things. I did try quite hard, but then I sent it all off up to my supervisor in Cambridge, and he sent it all back saying I should do some studies of normal histology of normal bone.
And, this is Arthur Jennings, is it?
Yeah. And I really felt, you know, I'm sorry, I can't do it. And it was just a bit too much. So, you know, I'd done my BAS report for the dogs, and I'd been in touch with Andrew Bellows by then. And
also tried to write it up for BAS Bulletin, for Ray Adie, who was the editor of BAS Bulletin.
I don't remember that.
Andrew Bellows suggests that you tried to write it up in a BAS Bulletin, but the proof was sent back so many times by the editor, Ray Adie, for really nitpicking reasons, down to collars, etc.
Yeah.
But finally, the very patient Mike Godsell gave up and went on with his day job. Yeah. Is that not ringing
any bells? It doesn't ring a bell, actually. And I don't rule it out because one's memory fades, but I don't remember that.
Okay. But you do remember Jennings' recommendations and you kind of throwing in the towel at that point.
Yes, I do. Yes. Yeah.
But then Andrew Bellows did come to your rescue. What happened there?
Well, as far as I remember, I heard that he was going, and I thought, lucky old you. You know, and,
yes.
You know, I said, well, you've got to take an X-ray machine, because that's one thing you will find necessary. And, you know, we had long chats about it all, but, you know, and off he went. I mean, it was... I was very jealous at the time.
So he was going down to follow up your work, really, to see...
I think, yeah. Well, he went down to, you know, yes, and he was much more interested in hereditary disease. He did quite a lot of work on the entropion business, and he got the detailed breeding of the dogs much more organised than I ever did. And I think he did a lot of work on that, actually.
And when he came to write up his report, he approached you?
Yeah, and I said, well, you know, by all means, have all my stuff. And he kindly made me a joint author, which was, you know, an idle way of doing it. But
I presume that's an unintentional pun, joint author.
Austin yes. yes. How quick you are, yes.
No, I thought of it last night.
Yeah.
So when the when the joint paper was published, I think, a couple of years later or so, did it rock the world?
Did people I don't think so,
take
no.
notice?
I don't think it did. I wasn't aware of any great, you know.
Was that because Bass were not paying attention to findings about their animals?
I don't think so. I honestly don't know, but I mean, they did then take Bob down, Bob Bosman, as a wintering vet, and there must have been some continuity, presumably, between the three of us. But I don't think I met him before he went, actually, and didn't have much.
Well, here you were clearly saying that the workloads were too great for the welfare of the dogs. Were you not?
I don't ever think I said as much. I wouldn't have discouraged using them.
No.
I was just aware of the results and used them. But, I mean, how could I sort of say, you know, the weight of a sledge is too much? I mean, for goodness sake, if the sea ice is flat and so on, you load it up as high as you can, don't you? And it's... I think the conditions dictate how much you pull on the sort of feelings for the dogs.
So was there any consequence of your work? Did Bass adjust their procedures in any way that you're aware of?
I don't think so, particularly, except that I think they realised that it was not sensible to keep dogs past their working life. And I think that's true because, as you know, subsequently we all... they're upsetting the ecology of seal life around the bases and so on. And I think that probably was true. But now there are, you know, so many seals I gather down there now, you hardly see an ice floe without a seal on it now. But it's, in those days, really round, you know, for 10 miles or 15 miles around each base, they were fairly few and far between.
Mm. Well, they were being bumped off to feed the dogs.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. There was a change there because... again, according to Andrew Bellar's notes, there was a more decisive policy regarding the dogs, their breeding and their use, and that was implemented at the stations in the 69-70 season. And it was decided that new breeding stock should be introduced from Greenland.
Yes, I gathered they had brought some in, which I think Andrew had to do with that. Yeah. But as I say, he'd done a lot of work on the breeding, which I hadn't done. And the possibility of hereditary diseases and so on.
Yeah. Were you surprised when dogs were outlawed in the Antarctic?
Yes, I was, actually. I'd never sort of thought that it would happen somehow, but I wasn't aware of the, you know, sort of day-to-day goings-on at the time. And so looking back on it, I can understand that they would be upsetting the ecology, but whether they've actually taken it too far or not, I don't know. But it's a great loss from the people on the bases standpoint, because the dogs are a terrific centre point of one's, you know, sort of social life and so on. It was, and I'm sure they all, very, very few of the base members would have not liked having dogs there.
So you were aware of the therapy that they provided, were you?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Not at Sydney, possibly, because they were, you know, spare there. But certainly on the sledging bases, they were a part of base life. And it's nice to have another species there anyway, I think, actually. Not going as far as the two cats and the and Dero Peso, but I think Peso probably contributed quite a bit to the base life. But
how have those few months lodged in your psyche? Do you think that time south changed you at all in any way, or was there anything you learnt that from your time in the Antarctic which you've kind of used in your life since?
You certainly learn never to forget it. And it was the most wonderful time. I simply adored it. I think you do learn to be helpful. You know, if you see somebody carrying something, it's like unloading the avgas. You know, you don't try and carry a barrel on your own. And, you know, it was very striking on the way out that the people who'd been down there for a couple of years, they'd always be on the other end of your suitcase if it was heavy. You know, it's extraordinary how nice they were. And, you know, I've tried to remember that as a lesson for life, really. I don't suppose it always happens, but...
This is the kind of the FID philosophy of all mucking in together to get the job
absolutely
done.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, yes, yeah. All mucking in is exactly the
expression. Do you still remember the beauty of the Antarctic?
Oh, yes. It's a stunningly beautiful place. But you do, you know, when I've given talks to the Women's Institute and things, you know, you say you don't get the idea that it's always like this because the sun doesn't shine half as often as my slides will indicate. And because then, you know, you don't take photographs when it's really foul weather outside.
So what happened to Mike Godsall in the rest of your veterinary career?
Then when I left Cambridge, I joined John Parker as in practice. And we had a successful practice, actually. And it's unbelievable how it grew. We had... there were two of us. I think we were on our own, just the two of us, for about 2.5 years, and we got an assistant, another Cambridge graduate, of course. And
naturally.
And naturally. And then we went up to four, and then it's now, I think there's 13 vets in the practice now, and not all full-time, because, they have girls there now as well. You know, well, of course they do, more female graduates now than there are male. So,
are you still in touch
with John?
With the vet, with the practice? Are you still?
Oh yes, rather. Yeah, yeah. I actually take my dog back there because it's cheaper than going to the local vet. I can tell you.
Did he ever get any huskies turp?
I had when I came back. When I was still at Cambridge, there was a chap called Keith Barnett, who sadly died a couple of years ago, who was an expert on eyes, and he used to do the work for the guide dogs for blind, and because sadly a lot of guide dogs were getting retinal atrophy and going blind themselves, which is a horrible thought. And he came back from the guide dog centre at Exeter one day, and he said, "Mike," he said, "I've got just the dog for you." He said, so I said, "Oh, what's that?" He said, there's a beautiful looking Alaskan Malamute at Exeter, and it's not going to make a guide dog. So I went all the way down to Exeter, and you couldn't have it. And this dog, it was absolutely wonderful, beautiful thing. I've got a portrait of it upstairs. Beautiful dog, slightly bigger than a husky. And they keep them in sort of hard tennis courts, you know, great big compounds. And there was one or two full of Labradors. And then there was one with Lisa on her own, you know. And I went up to the edge of the wire and she came running over the tail going, "Ooh!" And I thought, "You've got to do this," you know. So she came back with me. But she was sent down from the guide dogs for chasing cats, which is, you can... But she was a character, and she was...
And you had her for some years?
Oh, long time, yes. Yeah. But she did have hip dysplasia. Yeah, she would, as a bachelor on my own in those days, to have a dog that didn't need an awful lot of exercise and couldn't jump over about 18 inches was actually an advantage. And she lived till she was 11 and, saw through me getting married and having children and so on. And she was absolutely wonderful, super dog. And she was, she did like cats, there's no doubt about that. But I trained her eventually with a rope and, you know, choke chain on the end, and she'd take off. I'd stand, brace myself for the tug. And she learnt in the end, and we had cats in the same house. And she was fine, actually. She was a wonderful dog.
It's only a few months in the Antarctic, but how do you regard that little sojourn in your life? Is it a highlight or just another episode?
Oh, very much a highlight, yes, yes. You can't not remember things about it all the time, actually. I saw on the television last night.
Me too.
You know, I don't often look to see what's on BBC Four, but I'm jolly glad I saw it.
Time shift.
Absolutely, yes. Mm. Yeah. And you know that brings back memories, doesn't it? You know, it's great. And I read about it and see, you know, it was a wonderful time, actually. Almost, you know, the other time that was worth remembering was National Service, which I loved, actually, and it was great. And, I'm very good at, you know, in those days, I'm good at being told what to do, I think. And, it's fun. Great place. And the Falklands, of course. I adored that town, Falklands. They were such nice people. And I got very upset when the war was on. I think my family thought I was a frightful bore. I used to listen to every news bulletin with that chap from the Foreign Office who read at dictation speed. Do you remember that?
Mm.
Port St. Carlos was... was where I first was. I spent 5 days there because flew in. You know, Cameron met me on the jetty, practicing his golf swing with an umbrella. I've never forgotten it.
Who was that?
Cameron, who owned Port St. Carlos. Lovely chap, very great, and very civilized chap. And I spent 5 days there. And he was interesting chap, actually. I'm sure he's died now, he must be. He's quite considerably older than me. But that's where Alan Miller was, who was his head shepherd. And he was the one, I'm told, who discovered that the landline telephone was still open to Goose Green. And he managed to give them some warning on the telephone. And the Argentinians caught him and gave him a pretty hard time, and he died a couple of years later. Very sad. He's only a young chap.
So you really were caught up in the Falklands War as a consumer of the media.
I became very interested in it. Yes, because and I did know what they were talking about. And I didn't actually go to Goose Green, but I went to West Falkland and so on and all around the top.
Did you socialise much in the Falklands? Did you go to the dances?
Yes, I did actually. I was surprised to see my diary. Yes, there's a chap called Ian Strange, who was a zoologist and sort of amateur zoologist, I think, and had a... he was actually very kind, and he sort of took quite a lot of interest in what I was up to, and was very interested in the wildlife and so on. And I stayed with him and his wife, actually, while I was down there. And... Then it was, there were lots of, and the pubs were important. And, that lovely one on the main street, was it the Ship, I think it was? They heard that I was interested in penguins and so on, and also that I liked penguin eggs. And I think they were delicious, actually. I love them hard-boiled, they were delicious. And the day before we sailed to go south, there was a box delivered to Shackleton. There's a present from this pub, and I hope it wasn't as a reflection of how much I'd drunk there, but it could have had something to do with it, with a box of penguin eggs, which I thought was so nice of them, actually, quite uncalled for, and but really nice. And, they were very nice people. And, of course, the people out in the camp, I never saw any, apart from when the ship went in, once a week. With supplies and things, they hardly ever saw anybody outside. So they were terribly welcoming at Port Howard on the West Falkland. I had a birthday on the way out in April, and they heard it was my birthday, and it coincided with the Shepherd's Dance, which was a terrific party, and they all ride in from miles around. It was 145,000 acres or something, this particular farm, so it's quite a way to ride in on your ponies. And they made me a birthday cake. It was very, very kind. I was most impressed by it, actually. And there was one place at the top end of the East Falkland where Cameron took me in a thing called the Royal Box, which is because the wind was blowing, the aeroplane couldn't fly, so they thought they'd move me overland, which is a big tractor with four large wheels and a four-loader on the front, which is completely lined with sheepskins. And you sit on this thing and then get lifted up like that. And you go off across the because there were no roads in those days at all. And it was called the Royal Box because the governor used to use it when he was fishing. And he'd come up and stay with the camera and they'd go off. And but Cameron said what I was going to say with this next chap. He said, I hope you enjoy, he said, but he's a bachelor and he's got the worst cook in the Falkland Islands. And so it proved. It was unbelievable how this chap put up the food that this lady cooked for him.
Did you go to the hospital?
Did I go to it?
Hmm.
I saw it and I had a chat with Slessor. Several times I saw him actually. It seemed fine actually. But I was a bit shocked when I heard about his advice about hydrated. Don't put that in in this report to UK. But and he when I was talking to him about hydrated, and he did sound quite interested. And I got hold of the colonial secretary and said, I think we really have got to do something about this because I know they've only had one case so far, but they're going to get more without a shadow of doubt. And I gather so it's proved. I don't know the facts, but it's alarming. Because if you talk to Australians and New Zealanders about how the children are brought up, they have to wash their hands after they touch a dog and, you know, and it's for the same reason. And it's sad that it wasn't, you know, more notice wasn't taken of it, really.
Shall we? Is there anything else you want me to? Anything else you wanted to say?
I think we've had a lovely chat. Enjoyed it. No, I don't think so. Chris, thank you.
Thank you.